You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
I don't need to tell our listeners what an unusually hot, dry summer it's been in Michigan. The weather's been tough on lawns, on agricultural crops, and especially difficult on those who work to prevent fires, wildfires in particular. People like our next guest, Elaine Bush, who is a Michigan State University Extension educator and FireWise Project Director. Elaine, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Elaine, for some of our listeners who may not have known about FireWise from previous interviews we've had, a little bit about the project. What is it that you try and do, and how long have you been around?
FireWise is a national partnership. Began in the mid-'80s when pretty much everyone thought big forest fires happened in California, nowhere else. But we soon learned that wasn't the case. So it was a collaboration with the USDA Forest Service, state forest agencies, the National Fire Protection Agency, and similar ones. And it grew, it developed. You know, they eventually had their own websites and trainings and materials. And Michigan first became involved in about 2002 when Mark Hansen, who was emergency management specialist at MSU at that point, wrote some grants to do some pilot programs. And he first started in the southern 30 or so counties of the Lower Peninsula, but later realized the Lake Michigan shoreline, the UP, the northeast part of the Lower Peninsula were very much at risk for wildfires. And so he got additional grant funds and expanded staffing, and that's how I first got involved. Then when Mark retired last July, he said, well, why don't you just take the project over and keep it running? So that's pretty much what I've been doing the last year, is doing more of the administrative part of the program.
Yeah, so we had Mark on the show several times, as you know. One little factoid that Mark liked to mention, and that our listeners may not be aware of, that there are between 8,000 and 10,000 wildfires in Michigan every year.
There are, and they range from small grass fires that you might not even notice up to large, large fires. You know, this year we've already had the Duck Lake fire in Luce County that started in late May, and it is now the third largest fire in Michigan history because of the size of it. It took 3 weeks for them to completely get it out. I looked the other day on the DNR's website, and in the first 7 months of this year, because of the weather we were having this year, we've had 412 fires, where all of 2011, there were only 135 fires. And, of course, you know, the acreage can vary, like I say, but that Duck Lake fire helped put the total acreage up pretty darn high this year. So it was something like 21,000 acres, I think, it consumed. So,
Elaine, one thing that's been in the news recently, and I'm sure you've been tracking it, the new fireworks laws, which has essentially liberalized the use of fireworks. But that's got to be a particular concern to you and to all those who are involved in FireWise.
It is. We've had such drought conditions this year, as has over half the country, in severe drought, that when you're now allowed to sell and use what are considered consumer-grade fireworks, the ones that leave the ground, even if you're careful handling them so you're not having any injuries to yourself or your guests, they may land in a pile of dry leaves or dead pine needles or something, and they're still pretty hot when they land on the ground, and that can start a fire. And especially when it was windy and dry as it was over the holidays here, there was a lot of concern. I know even some of the communities that are more urban were worried about problems happening with the fireworks. So it's fun to enjoy those products, but you always need to use extreme caution and be really, really aware of the weather conditions. So that's one new law this year that's kind of had a lot of people concerned. So,
well, whether you're doing fireworks or having a campfire at home or on the road or maybe even doing a little brush burning, what are some things that people need to be particularly concerned about, Elaine, given the weather conditions this year?
Again, always be aware of the weather conditions and your surroundings. The campfire safety, whether it's in your backyard or out in the woods where you are, you need to select a site that you've cleared that doesn't have huge branches overhead. You know, scrape the ground off if you have the ability to line it with rocks or bricks, or you have a campfire ring, say, in your yard, do that. Always make sure you have some water source handy and you know, a rake or a shovel at hand and probably a cell phone. Never leave your campfire, just like never leave any brush burning that you're doing. Often campfires can travel underground after you think they're out. So if you haven't totally doused them with water, stirred them up, and doused them again, then you may leave and think it's out, and the embers can get some of the underground material and travel along and flare up somewhere else. So, you know, there's a lot of responsibilities preparing the site while having the campfire and then post-campfire. And again, the DNR website has some excellent tip sheets that people can look at. We have our own website, firewise.msu.edu, that has some great materials on it, as does the national website, the firewise.org website. So, you know, again, brush burning is another issue. People think they can do that, and they forget how windy things are, and the embers get out of control, and pretty soon they've caught the dry grass in the next field on fire and then their neighbor's house, and they forget that they're responsible for any fire, campfire, brush fire, whatever, that gets out of control. You're responsible for the damage, and the DNR and the fire departments may bill you for all the cost of their time and their equipment and their expense, as well as neighbors who lose property may, you know, pursue legal action against you. So always be careful, knowing that you're responsible financially and otherwise for any burning that you do.
My guest is Elaine Bush, who's an MSU Extension educator and also the director of the Firewise Project. Elaine, you just mentioned something that, frankly, I hadn't heard before, even from Mark, and that is the availability of a cell phone. A lot of folks probably panic and try and put these fires out themselves when maybe the first thing they ought to do is have that fire department number on the cell phone queued up.
Probably would be a good idea because, you know, they can come out with their equipment, and after you've called them, if you want to try doing something yourself, you know, if you've got the hose right there, great. But, you know, I think I mentioned to you earlier that we had some fires here recently up and down US 31, and fortunately the fire department was alerted right away and they came out, but because of the dryness again, it possibly was a vehicle pulling something and chains were dragging and sparking, or it could have been a big commercial semi or something that had something dragging, and it started several grass fires for about a 4 or 5 mile stretch along US 31 on a Saturday afternoon. Some of them burned into an orchard up a hill, moved real rapidly up the hill, another up a hill that was all pine covered. You can go out there now and see the beautiful willow and pine trees behind the burn area are all brown and scorched just from the heat. They never even got touched by the flames, but the heat was so intense, it's pretty much killed those trees behind it. So it's a good lesson, I think, for all of us to know that just something like that, that spark on the pavement, can shoot into the dry, dry fields and grass right next to it and start a fire so fast that moves along that, you know, you've got to be extremely careful. And because it was daytime and they got the fire folks right out there, the damage was limited to about 10 acres of burn, and no homes, no buildings or anything were damaged. They were very, very lucky.
And I know, Elaine, we've been talking about a very hot, dry summer, but some of the tips that you just mentioned and some of those on your website also apply to other times of the year. People shouldn't be less vigilant just because it's fall or winter.
That's true. And, yeah, we have some tips for how you can maintain your yard, especially if you're doing spring cleanup or fall cleanup, so that if you're in an area where a wildfire might occur, you know, if you keep the first 30 to 50 feet around your home trimmed with all kinds of brush and loose material cleaned up, and you keep it well watered, and any trees you have, you limb up to at least 6 to 10 feet off the ground. You don't have them too close together. You space them out well and keep the branches away from your roof. You clean out your eaves and any other part of the roof that might have dead pine needles or leaves up there. That way, if a fire does occur, if it comes through, it's not going to get to the size and intensity that's going to catch all those things on fire. We've got some excellent pictures Mark provided years ago that show that. You know, one house burned, and right across the road where it's all green and well-maintained, the fire came up to it and just burned itself out. So, you know, any of those kind of things are very helpful. Yeah, we do have some materials online that tell you some of the things you can do. Pretty easy, pretty inexpensive landscaping tips. You know, use rock and cement and non-burnable products for landscaping and home construction versus things that will burn, clean out under decks, and any places where things like that can collect and be up against your house so that if an ember does come and land in that, there's nothing for it to burn.
Well, some excellent tips, and it's the FireWise Project, MSU Extension. I've been talking with Elaine Bush, who is the FireWise Project Director, also an MSU Extension Educator. Elaine, great talking to you, and wonderful tips for our listeners.
Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Join the MSUAA family, and you're instantly connected to our network of over 500,000 Spartans in every corner of the world. Whether it's community, connections, career growth, or class, that's what the MSU Alumni Association is all about. Join the world's largest Spartan Nation community at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
MSU AgBio Research is changing the face of science.
People should know that AgBio Research is really the first front at MSU dealing with environmental issues and natural resources issues.
Dr. Steve Papke leads MSU AgBio Research. More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
MSU AgBio Research really is changing the face of science. If we can do that right, we create economic opportunities here in Michigan and opportunities for our researchers to make some really interesting discoveries.
Our goal is to generate economic prosperity, sustain natural resources, and enhance the quality of life for all.
We're MSU AgBio Research.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu. MSU AgBio Research is changing the face of science.
Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome Charlie Hasselman to our program. Charlie wears a number of hats, including helping us launch Business Connect, our efforts to make a single portal for big and large businesses to be able to access MSU's expertise a bit better, along with developing the idea of Spartan Innovations, which sits now with Business Connect and in an overall umbrella of Innovation Center. So I don't know what at this point in time, you're not only the director of the Innovation Center, you're probably the guy who's handling Spartan Innovations and also a bit of Business Connect
that
until we
true.
Get all of these positions.
we're recruiting actively.
Okay. But one of the real criticisms about universities is sort of we're impenetrable to business,
right,
large
right.
and small. So talk about ways in which you and the organizations you've helped create are trying to make that a little bit easier.
So I think, that really comes down to the Business Connect mission of how do we show up in all sorts of different contexts for the private sector. I go bigger than just businesses. It really is anyone in that private sector. How do we be responsive? How do we help them navigate? We really take a job very seriously of being a concierge to those people and to those companies. We do it both ways. We're both responsive. People who call us, people who come to us, who are trying to get into the university. We're quick. We're rapid. We get them an answer. Sometimes the answer is no, but we get them a no quickly. That's what they appreciate. The other way around is that we really do try to market our strengths, right? So the university has some fabulous pockets of strength academically, and we have to take those out on the road. We have to find companies who either don't know us or know of us but haven't figured out how to work with us, and we're proactively going out and making them our partners or working hard to get them to be our partners. So it's a two-way street. And it's not just about big companies who might fund research. It's also about entrepreneurs, little one-man small businesses who want to make their way into the university, but they can't afford it. And so we try to find win-win ways to do that. Most recently, we actually got some money from the MEDC to stimulate that sort of activity. So along with the other URC universities, we wrote an application for a grant, and we were awarded money to do three different things with companies, or five different things, really. The most important three were that we have money to do research partnerships for companies at a scale that they don't really have the dollars it would take to do an advanced project with the university. We have matching funds to do that with them. We have money to put interns into small companies. And then we have a program where we'll do what we call these instant innovation sessions, where we'll take a group of faculty from all three of the URC universities and put them in a room with the thinkers of a universe of a company and brainstorm around what they're trying to solve in their company. And in the end, those ideas belong to the company. So it really is ways that we're helping stimulate the economy.
So when you step back and look at all the things that you do, what's the common goal of everyone that's working with you, for you? What's the one thing that you'd put out there as this is our common goal?
So I think the common goal is create value from the university's intellectual assets. We have so many things going for us that the translation from here to there, from here to the market, is hard, really very hard. And it's at small scale where we have a patent that we think ought to be an interesting technology that makes it to a company, or it's at large scales where big companies really need help, but they have no idea how to connect to the university. So it really is about how do we translate and connect our assets to the commercial world.
You talked a little bit about internships with some of the businesses. As far as students on campus or maybe some recent graduates, what are some of the values that go back to that core of population, I guess, that you'd be...
To the students. Well, so there's so many different ways we're connecting with students now. The intern experiences are very valuable, as it helps them sort out their career choices. They think they want to be X, Y, or Z, and they get to go out and actually do it. And it's an experience that helps the company. They get a pair of hands, a smart pair of hands that comes and helps with them with what they're doing. But those kids get a chance to learn. I think in other ways, when we start talking about Spartan Innovations or internship programs that we run in MSU Technologies, where we actually are putting these kids to work in very serious ways that I think are very meaningful experiences for their futures. So as an example, we haven't talked about Spartan Innovations, so maybe I should introduce that first.
Right.
Spartan Innovations is a collaboration between ourselves, the university, and the MSU Foundation. The foundation is a standalone not-for-profit corporation that is the beneficiary of the assets from the university's intellectual property. So when we put cisplatin and carboplatin, two very successful drugs on the market, the money that the university made from that went into the foundation's bank account. And the foundation uses that money to support the university's mission and a lot focused on research. The foundation... In its mission to help the university, and I guess in a certain sense to evergreen its fund, sees that one of the ways it can help is to help us with commercializing our assets, because those things will feed back to the fund. And so Spartan Innovations was created to help us start companies from university assets. So that's the nuts and bolts of what Spartan Innovations is.
But I think that it is true that that there are some faculty members who are extraordinary presidents of companies. And we've had one in chemistry as an example who is a serial inventor. His last company was just purchased. He's back now in the lab, but he has every intention of starting another company another new invention, and he likes that cycle of But there are others who would just as soon stay in the lab and aren't really interested with finding financing and doing some of the other kinds of things. So Spartan Innovations is designed to...
It really helps us bring what I call professional help to our effort. When we've got a faculty member or a patent or a copyright that's commercially interesting, but we don't have that faculty member who has the drive that Luana references, when we have that situation and we need the professional help, Spartan Innovations is going to bring together teams of what we'll call mentors in residence, or CEOs in residence, or entrepreneurs in residence. The name doesn't really matter. It's it's an experienced person who's done a startup before, who understands market, who understands product, because a patent, a technology patent, isn't a product. Right. There's so much work to be done to turn that raw idea into a product with a plan and a strategy that would get it to a market. And so we need that help. We need those professionals to come help us do that. And so mentors in residence will come, and then back to the students, we're going to put together multidisciplinary teams of students on scholarship, actually, with money from the foundation to come help us. So whether that's PhDs who are familiar with the technology, or MBAs who are wise about market matters, or whether it's really bright undergrads who are just really geeked about entrepreneurism, bring those teams of kids together with the mentor, with the faculty member, with the technology, build the plan for both the market and the technology, and then we will use some money that's in the Spartan Innovations pot to actually fund some of that pre-competitive, pre-company stuff to get this idea to a product with a plan that now we'll get a private investor interested in and spin that company out.
Mark, you talk often about the culture around athletics. And part of, I think, what Spartan Innovations is designed to do is take some of that ecosystem, that culture that has grown up around Silicon Valley and other places organically over a very long period of time. It wasn't always like that. And try to jumpstart that right here in mid-Michigan and East Lansing. And then but be sure that we include our students in the front end of that, not simply wait till they become sort of the entrepreneur.
That was going to be a question I had is as you work with all, I'm assuming you work with most all colleges on campus.
Absolutely.
And then cast a net out, and that net has to go global, I would assume. You know, where you make those connections is still an interesting question I guess I would have of you of how you take Silicon Valley, how you take other areas of, you know, the financial business on the East Coast, how you bring that into East Lansing.
Well, that is, in fact, I think one of the most important things about Spartan Innovations is creating that network. And it really is about people who know people. And we have lots of great alumni who know lots of people, right? We have alumni everywhere.
Right.
And they're in Silicon Valley. They're in Boston. They're in San Diego. They're already there.
Right.
So it's a question of how do we get back with them with this idea. I mean, honestly, they're hungry for this. Mm-hmm. They're very excited about what we're doing here, and they would love to help us. So now we're creating the opportunity for them to come help us. And some structure and a way to bring ideas forward, and then we'll, you know, whether it's a medical device or a piece of software, there's always going to be somebody who's out there who's appropriate to help us, and we're going to reach out, and we're going to have professionals who they can talk to and really get a productive dialogue going about whether it's about technical help getting it forward or whether it's about money. We're going to be able to make those connections and over time build that network and make it much more robust.
To me, it seems like you must come in the office every day and just shake your head because there's so much potential there.
Absolutely.
And it's what do you focus on
exactly
at
right.
any given point in time. It just it seems like such a big palette that you have to paint.
It really is true.
Yeah.
It really is true. We have really, some of the challenge here is to pick opportunities, right, to make sure that we're focusing our limited resources because, you know, every organization suffers limited resources. We have to pick the best opportunities, and that's hard because you're predicting the future
right.
because these are raw technologies, and so we do our best.
It's sort of like recruiting basketball players
yeah, there you
or football
go.
Players.
Well, exactly
it sounds
right.
a little bit like if you have more fundraisers, you'll raise more money. If you, you know, like my wife, if I buy more things on sale, I'll save more money. It's kind of a exponentially. I just can't imagine the opportunities that are out there and how you go through that process of
right.
of honing in on the ones that perhaps would have the greatest impact,
yeah.
the greatest return.
Part of it's about patience because we aren't a corporation with a single-minded goal of creating a product. Right? We're not that laser focused as a university. We have so many things we do. Part of it is about being patient and moving these things forward at the pace that you can move them forward. And at some level, there's some self-identification of what are the best opportunities because they're the ones that move.
And if somebody wanted to learn about the projects you're working on, if somebody wanted to get engaged
yep.
in the projects that you're working on, how would they go about tracking on that?
So again, Business Connect, we answer all phone calls. And so that's a great way in. Spartan Innovations, MSUT, we have a very active web presence. We're pretty easy to find. The university just put up a new web presence around innovation and entrepreneurism. So I think just right off the homepage at Michigan State University, you'll find us very quickly. And then for us, it's a lot of outreach and a lot of connecting. And so it's so that we're easy to find.
But if you want one phone number, just look up Business Connect.
I'm Russ White for the MSU Department of Radiology and MSU Health Team. Mary Thiel is a physical therapist and manager of MSU's Rehabilitation Medicine Clinic.
We are ancillary services to physician services. So there's physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and psychology services, as well as lymphedema treatment. Lymphedema is swelling in the interstitial tissues. The program began as out of need for treatment of women in particular, status post breast surgery, mastectomies, lumpectomies, and lymph node removal, and they develop swelling in an extremity or in their chest or elsewhere. And it's a program that combines manual lymph drainage, so it's a type of a massage, along with teaching bandaging and fitting a custom compression garment. And it's fairly significant, the work that they do. It's expanded to where not only are they treating post-mastectomy, but any sort of swelling, whether it be post-operative, bilateral low extremity swelling because of complex chronic conditions. It's really quite a service to mid-Michigan and to the immediate community as well. Their results are short of miraculous.
It's all about teamwork at the MSU Rehabilitation Clinic and the MSU Health Team.
We have an excellent relationship with MSU Sports Medicine, as well as the rest of the MSU Health Team. And we get anything from sports injuries to neurological disorders, persons with injury, whether it's central or peripheral. And we try and tailor that specific rehabilitation to that person's needs. So we have therapists who have niches. So we have therapists who specialize in sports medicine, post-operative care. We have therapists who specialize in manual skills, so spine. And we have specialists who work more with rehabilitation type traditional neurological insults, Parkinson's, any sort of dystrophy. So it's quite an eclectic environment, which makes it fun and interesting for everyone. And I think the different patient populations kind of inspire one another. Our occupational therapist and our neuropsychologists, they have developed a program for cognitive retraining, which is especially relevant with the more head injuries that we're seeing, more concussions we're seeing in athletes, the persons coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, trying to treat these intermediate brain injury issues where they might be diagnosed with a concussive disorder, but they're not getting treatment. They're healing, so their pain is gone, but when they get into an area where they need to focus their attention, they're unable to do so. And they've developed a program in order to retrain those processing functions. It's really, again, another fascinating aspect of this practice that we're a part of. So we get inspiration from each other, whether we're specialists in neurology or we're specialists in spine or we're specialists in orthopedic. We can draw from one another to have optimal outcomes. In terms of our larger department, what's wonderful about it is there's such a good relationship with sports medicine, with radiology, with nutrition, and with rehab that we're able to provide better care for our patients because we know that sports medicine physician. We know the radiologist who looked at your X-ray or your MRI. We can refer you for your nutritional needs, and it makes preventative care better. It makes outcomes longer lasting without sounding too kitschy. Kind of our motto is educate, engage, and empower. And we all strongly believe in that we want the patient to take an active role in their care. And once we can educate them and show them the techniques to improve themselves, they're now empowered to go ahead and have better health. So it's a great relationship. It's wonderful to work with all these professionals.
MSU's Mary Thiel explains the difference between physical therapy and occupational therapy.
Physical therapy is more what we call gross motor skills, so your larger movement. So, for example, we'll take a runner. They come in with knee pain. So we take a look at their strength, their range of motion, some special tests, how their core is, then put them on the treadmill. How are you running? Can you run? What are their asymmetries between right and left sides? How they're loading through as they're jogging or running? And then divvy that out into a program that's tailored to that client's needs and then continue to reevaluate so that they can achieve their goals. Occupational therapy usually deals with a little bit more fine motor skills. It's not just hands. Usually it is some upper extremity stuff. But in addition to upper extremity treatment, hands, our occupational therapist, like I said, does some cognitive retraining, sensory perception skills and drills, as well as activities of daily living. So if someone's having a difficulty with dressing, or they need to get in and out of a car, or they need energy conservation, they might see our occupational therapist to evaluate those needs as well.
Mary Thiel says the mission of the MSU Rehabilitation Clinic is to help its patients to not just survive, but to thrive.
Our mission is to enhance the health of the community, to help them rebound after any sort of injury, whether it's cognitive or more musculoskeletal. One of our neuropsychologists like to say it's not just about surviving, it's about thriving and trying to get individuals to value what they're doing and how they're moving through space so they can get to that point where they're not just surviving, but thriving. And that's what goes on here. It's a very upbeat environment. There is a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm for what we do. We like establishing that relationship with patients. We get better outcomes that way as well. So anyone from myself as the clinic manager to our reception area, we like to see and hello and greet people and how are you doing and like to see that progress. It's not only satisfying for the patient and client, it's truly satisfying for us. We really enjoy recovery and staying healthy.
Please visit the MSU Rehabilitation Clinic online at rehab.msu.edu.
Turn it up! Turn it up a little bit higher. Radio, turn it up, burn it up, so you know. Radio.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Rick Foster is the Kellogg Chair in Food, Society, and Sustainability at Michigan State University and co-director of Metro Foods Plus Innovation Cluster at Detroit, which was described in a press release as Detroit and MSU working together to develop a broad program of food system innovation to promote local economic development, land recovery, and food security. And Rick, that's what the press release says. How would you describe MSU Metro Food and its mission?
Well, Russ, I think we would certainly have all those aspects that has been reported as part of the work, but I would put it just a little bit differently, I think. I think Metro Food Plus, the initiative is about addressing the significant needs that face the city of Detroit and many other post-industrial cities around this country at this current time, looking at blight and abandonment as the asset we need in the future to look at food production in a increasingly urbanizing environment. Globally, and learning about how we can go about doing that in the U.S. that has an impact on our global cities around the world.
And Rick, I've heard President Simon describe the initiative as transforming Detroit and positioning the city as a world center for urban food systems, technology, and development. What does that mean?
Well, I think one of the other things President Simon had mentioned in our conversations earlier is that if we really look at the global trends, not only in the U.S. but around the world, we see some really sometimes frightening kinds of things happening out there. So I'm going to maybe paint that bigger picture for you and then talk about how Detroit can be a part of the solution finding around it. If we look out the next 40 years, and I know that that's a long time, but things happen very rapidly, and what we think of happens in 40 years usually happens much quicker than that nowadays. But if we look out in a 2050 kind of a time frame, we find that this world is very, very different than what we currently, you know, witness it or experience it. One of the things is that the population of this world will be 9.3 billion people, up from about 7 billion today. And it will be approximately 70% of those people will live in large cities. So when we think of a Mexico City, for example, today of having 35 million people, the largest city in the Americas, maybe in the world, and that's in a metropolitan kind of a population, what happens to that city when it's actually 60 million people? And what happens when you put that many people together and ask the questions, the very fundamental questions about food, about water, and about energy? Well, multiply that times the cities that we know of in China, in India, in Africa. Less so in Europe and the U.S., but certainly still significantly impacted by that kind of issues. And we find out that maybe the three most prominent issues that we have to face are how we will feed ourselves, how we do it with using less energy than we currently use, and how we do it with less water than we currently use. And we think that if we address Detroit's issues right now of blight and abandonment, of being a food desert, of having significant fundamental public health issues, chronic unemployment, we can actually address those in a way that we can help Detroit now position it for future success as a thought leader in these areas and be a global asset in the future.
And Rick, what are some of the key 21st century food, water, and energy challenges for urban populations, Rick, that the initiative hopes to address?
Well, when you look at the U.S., Russ, we talk about these post-industrial cities. Detroit normally is one of those cities that people point to, but there's actually about 50 of those cities around this country. And they are cities that are characterized by being large population centers that have emptied out in the last 40 years or so. And the characteristics is blighted and abandoned lands, empty buildings that were built at a time when they're very structurally sound, and they are sometimes about marginalized people still in the cities, but tend to be lower income, tend to be minority, tend to have less opportunity. So we think that if we start to look at the U.S. and how we start to repurpose that abandonment, we can actually be a global asset while we do the repurposing in those cities. So that's what we kind of mean by kind of the U.S. context for it. But if I go globally, it's a very significantly different issue in that cities like Johannesburg, South Africa, like Chennai, India, Hyderabad, India, many cities in China are going to be so heavily populated that they won't have land on which they can grow food. So they'll grow food in vertical structures, or they'll grow food maybe in a 300-mile radius of a city, and we will be dependent upon in the future the ability for a city to grow its own food within a reasonable food set of food miles, if you would. So let me just paint the scenario differently as well. If we do have 9.3 billion people in 2050, we will have to double our food production to feed that many people. And if we think about the issues that we currently face with water resources, with energy resources, we will have to actually double that food production using less water than we currently use and less energy than we currently use. Now, some would say that's impossible to do, but we would say that we have an opportunity in thinking this way because we can invent the food system production possibilities of the future. And why not do that in Detroit and export that globally? So we think that anytime we can link the development of a city like Detroit or like Pittsburgh or like Philadelphia or St. Louis or any of the other post-industrial cities, if we can link that to what is relevant in a global context, we're assuring those cities' relevancy going into the future.
Rick Foster is my guest on MSU Today. He's leading a new initiative between Michigan State University and the City of Detroit, Metro Foods Plus Innovation Cluster at Detroit. And Rick, can you detail a little bit more about MSU's role and what you and your colleagues will be doing?
Well, MSU has a significant set of experiences that we've gained globally. So the whole model, if we would, of prosperity and sustainability in communities is what's important to us. And we see that as our role of not only a land-grant university, many would say the first land-grant university in our 150-year history that we're currently celebrating, but also, as President Simon likes to say, our world-grant vision. Our world-grant vision says that we need to take this knowledge and experience that we have gained and apply it in a prosperity and sustainability model anywhere we can. Well, that then says to us that a lot of our future development is going to be based on innovation, working in community with people who are already there, who are trying to make their livelihood in those communities. So our role is going to be present, to listen, critically important that we listen to people in the community, to businessmen in the community who seek alternative options, to listen to government and the City of Detroit and how they want to align their policies to make this happen and how can we help them do that. So we need to be a resource and an asset on the ground to those people. One of the ways we can do that is to actually establish a center in Detroit around food systems innovation. And so one thing we want to do, the only physical structure we really envision building is one in which brings futuristic I'm going to call it a greenhouse kind of an environment for growing food indoors. But it may not look like a typical greenhouse. But it's got to be a place where we can attract cutting-edge technologies from around the world to Detroit and have them exist, coexist in a space that feed off each other and create new innovation. So we hope to build in the next several years, in the next couple of years, a physical structure, an innovation site that we can attract global technologies and start a process of putting them together to talk about indoor growing systems.
Rick Foster, can you summarize the potential you see for the Urban Food Systems Innovation Project to revitalize Detroit's economy?
Well, it's difficult to quantify. So the vision we have is that in an immediate 1 to 5 year kind of a time frame, that we add value to those operations, those food producing operations in the city as they currently exist and can grow with new technologies and new innovation so that there's more jobs, greater food availability, the food system is more socially acceptable, which means equitably available to everyone, and that the jobs are created out of this. We anticipate that, the city of Detroit, we know, has got about 70% of its population live in what we call a food desert. And that basically says that they do not have access to fresh fruits and vegetables in a quantity they need to consume for good health. What happens if we can improve that and create greater availability? What happens if we could actually grow jobs around producing food, but produce enough food that we actually process it and maybe even market it regionally or nationally or even internationally? So we see this as an immediate impact upon elimination of blight, transition of those resources that we tend to point out with disappointment, but what happens if it can be our asset for the future? So immediately that. Long term, we hope that Detroit is where people will look to, and Michigan State is a university where people look to for this global innovation around growing food in heavily populated areas.
And Rick, summarize what people should know now about this Metro Foods Plus Innovation Cluster at Detroit, and what are some of the immediate next steps in the project we'll see unfolding in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, I hope what people kind of take from what they read and we're in a development phase. We're definitely in a development phase, and Michigan State wants to do that in conjunction with people who already live in Detroit and are already making a significant progress, but maybe can have value added from a partnership with Michigan State and other knowledge-based institutions. We hope people will look at the potential for growth and not look at the political infighting that will certainly happen anytime you try to change a system. But to look to the long term for success that we can all experience together. I think patience is going to be important, but also in the spirit of innovation and entrepreneurship, I think it's how do we work together to create what we want for the city.
And Rick, in your mind, how will we know if it's been successful in a decade or two? If we look back, what do you hope to see?
If we were to look forward 10 years from now, and I think that's a safe bet to see actual change on the ground. I'm not sure if it's too much shorter than that, but 10 years down the road, I would see us being pretty much self-sufficient in food production to meet the needs of the city of Detroit. And that means that we would have increased food production on land and in buildings and starting to see the new cutting-edge technology addressing blight and abandonment in a positive way that's creating new jobs. I would think we're going to have a greener city, and by that I mean sustainability, fresh air, back to nature, more recreation and natural areas that have been converted from blighted areas. When I think, Russ, of the soils in Detroit, they're at varying toxicity levels and such that some soils can grow food immediately. Some should never be used to grow food. But we still have that blighted area that we have to contend with. And so I would like to think about how the city would have a new perspective about transitioning blight and abandonment to community value-added conditions like, for example, new parks. new recreation areas, new forest, if you would, urban forest, orchards, the kinds of things that we can repurpose contaminated lands in a variety of ways that all add value to the people of the city.
Rick, is there anything important I haven't asked you or anything you want to add about this cool initiative between MSU and Detroit?
Well, I would say that the thing to for us all to remember is that we're in this together. The citizens of Detroit, the business people in and of Detroit, even those with interests outside of the city that are active on an international level in food producing and processing and transportation, we're kind of looking at how do we strategically think about the city and its assets in a way that meets local needs but also is part of a global connection. I think what we all have to realize is that in a connected world, which we certainly are today, that the city will not thrive unless it is also connected globally. So the challenge, and I think we're up to it, is how do we make progress locally, connect it globally, so that we position Detroit as a global asset once again.
Rick Foster and I have been discussing the Metro Food Plus Innovation Cluster at Detroit, which he will lead. There's much more information online at msumetrofood.com. And Rick, before I let you go, if you can take off your Metro Foods hat and put on your Kellogg chair and sustainability hat. And I know we could probably have a 3-day conference on this, but I'm just curious, and it probably involves a lot of what we've already talked about. What kind of concerns you in the years ahead about this world becoming truly more sustainable, and then what are you hopeful about too?
Well, yeah, Russ, it's probably a conference in and of itself. But I think what I and several of my colleagues are working on together is what we call a global food platform. And in this, we look at all the dilemmas that can happen around food and its impact on this planet. And so we know, for example, that the way we use our petroleum resources is significant, and globally, most of our liquid petroleum is used around growing and transporting food. So if we can think about ways that we can use increased technologies to greatly reduce or greatly increase the efficiency of the way we use energy, the way we use water, we look at global food safety issues, the transportation of food globally, you know, this country actually imports food from 186,000 different sources around the world, not countries, but sources. And we know very little about, you know, how that happens at times. And so food safety with a rogue pathogen could raise great havoc in our global food system. So how do we think about those things, the public health issues, this urban convergence that we've talked about, how do we think about them together? And part of what we do with food society and sustainability framework is to link these knowledges together so that we consider them differently and maybe have an opportunity for problem solving differently as well. So a challenging piece that says that, my grandchildren who are, 3, 4, and 5 years old will live throughout this century and maybe even see the end of it. But they'll see a very, very different world than what I've seen, and their challenges will be very different than what I've ever faced. And so to me, it's about food, water, and energy, how they all come together for a quality life in the 21st century.
Rick, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us today, and congratulations on getting this cool initiative in Detroit underway. Spartans will.
Yes, Spartans, will. And we have a lot of Spartan supporters out there. Some are our alumni, but many of them simply recognize MSU as the great global asset that it is.
Rick Foster is the co-director of Metro Foods Plus Innovation Cluster at Detroit, which we've been discussing. And again, the website for more information, msumetrofood.com. And Rick is also the Kellogg Chair in Food, Society, and Sustainability at Michigan State University. I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
MSU AgBio Research is changing the face of science.
People should know that AgBio Research is really the first front at MSU dealing with environmental issues and natural resources issues.
Dr. Steve Papke leads MSU Ag Bio Research. More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
MSU Ag Bio Research really is changing the face of science. If we can do that right, we create economic opportunities here in Michigan and opportunities for our researchers to make some really interesting discoveries.
Our goal is to generate economic prosperity, sustain natural resources, and enhance the quality of life for all.
We're MSU Ag Bio Research.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu. MSU Ag Bio Research is changing the face of science.
MSU, we love thy shadows.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for alma mater.
So what that means is when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
And thy praises,
alumni.msu.edu. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.